still there?
Yep.
Okay. So, okay, so, yeah, this is a... It's a very good point that you're making, I think, about consciousness. What if it's a maladaption and we're going to get weeded out? I did have a response to it, but I just can't remember what it was. So I'll just go back to the point I was trying to make about language, which is that... Oh, I know what it was. It was, yeah, the whole sometimes works that if I put my attention on something else, the thing that I couldn't find comes just bounces right back. You notice that?
Yeah, that's it's the standard. It's the standard advice when you're stuck on something: stop thinking about it.
Yeah, because the thinking about it and trying to access it actually pushes it down into the unconscious somehow.
That's weird, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a whole other barrier, because we're talking about consciousness and now, of course, experiencing it. But I'll remember the point I was going to make, which is that this idea that consciousness is maladaptive because of destroying the environment and all that, that's an idea that you're talking about the tool, trying to analyze the tool that it is, that's an idea that is sourced in our kind of consciousness. Right? The whole idea that biology has a purpose, well, you already said it doesn't, but the whole idea that survival of the species is somehow more desirable than not, we couldn't have that idea if we weren't conscious.
But we could still behave the same way. And again, don't mix up consciousness with intelligence. It's really, really easy to imagine a Jason or a Peter meat robot that would, you know, we would still pull our hands away from a hot stove, except instead of feeling the subjective shrieking sensation of pain, there would just be an algorithm that says, you know, if surface temperature exceeds critical threshold, then withdraw with extreme prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
So intelligence, it's perfectly, in fact, I basically built a couple of books around this whole premise. It's perfectly reasonable to imagine an intelligent species built by natural selection would be just as likely to fuck up the planet as a conscious one. So I don't think it's necessarily consciousness so much as it is capacity, cognitive capacity, that can be the threat.
Okay, so what's cognitive capacity then?
Well, just in computation, the ability to... Like, you can see how natural selection would promote intelligence. You can see how natural selection would promote quick, on-the-fly... complex problem solving, because it gives you an adaptive advantage in the moment. What's a lot tougher to see is why any of those processes should be self-aware. Nobody's really been able to answer that yet, although there have been a lot of models out there to try. And in fact, there are some actual respected authorities who are starting to come around to the idea now that maybe consciousness isn't really useful for anything. It just happens to be a byproduct.
I guess you read Julian Jaynes, the bicameral mind thing, have you?
I'm familiar with the theory. I got as far in the original book as the phrase mounding fullness. and for some reason that phrase just stopped me dead.
What was it again?
Mounding fullness. Hmm. He was referring to consciousness as mounding fullness. What is this miraculous hump of mounding fullness or something? And I thought, okay, I have other things that I have to read right now.
That's great.
And I never got
like a trigger word.
But I'm familiar with his theory. Yeah.
Well, one thing occurs to me while I was reading the first part of that is when he was talking about self-consciousness, or rather, when he was talking about consciousness developing in human beings, he was actually referring to self-consciousness and self-awareness, as opposed to just being conscious, which I'd say animals are, of course, and many other creatures and organisms in the universe. Maybe everything is, for all we know. In the sense of being sentient, of having some rudimentary awareness, whereas James was talking specifically, I think, about this human phenomenon of being conscious of being conscious and being able to analyze one's consciousness. And Well, one of the points you made, so I'm not sure if this will be a sidetrack or not, but was that we are easy to condition as long as we're unconscious of that conditioning happening. Like he writes about various experiments that are done, for example, a professor in a class, and all the students laugh and smile and send out positive signals whenever he's at the left side of the classroom, and he gradually gravitates more and more to the left side and he stays there. And now, if he'd been conscious of that, of him being part of an experiment, it wouldn't have worked. So James's point is that unconsciousness is vulnerable to conditioning or easily conditioned, and this relates, I would say, to instinctive behavior. Self-consciousness, when we can analyze and understand things in a rational, at a rational, not just an instinctive level, prevents conditioning from occurring, or is a defense against it. Also, you could look at it either way.
Okay, but let's take that experiment one step further. Let's suppose that this guy isn't, I don't know, IBM supercomputer Watson, right? And there will be heuristics, or even better than Watson. Let's just say he's Julian Jaynes, but he's non-conscious. He's intelligent but non-conscious, and that there's a bunch of them, and that there is in fact some kind of positive survival aspect associated with being on the left side of the stage. At that point, as long as there's variation in the behavior, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that hugging the left side of the stage is going to be a behavior that gets promoted, yes, unconsciously, yes, consciously, but also instinctively. Like, it's not a if there's an actual payoff, to paraphrase Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, life will find a way. It doesn't really matter if you're consciously aware of it or not. If there's an advantage to be served, you will do it. And if you don't do it, your competitor will. So the next generation will consist of your competitor's offspring and not yours, and everybody will be on the left side.
So you're taking it back to the jungle, whereas the example was in the classroom, and in the classroom example, there wasn't really a payoff except to the professor's vanity. So
But
is it
isn't that a payoff? I mean, think about it. Everything we feel, we do not have sex. Birds do not grimly wander around putting sticks together because they think, well, it's time to increase my inclusive fitness. They do it because it feels good.
Well, I think I have to question that, though. Does it? Because is it that they do it because it feels good, or is it just that they do it and it feels good?
Yeah, but I mean, what would provide, would they do it if it didn't feel good? Would they do it if it hurt them?
Well, but I mean, wouldn't you have to presuppose a sort of interiority to birds of an emotional spectrum of happy, sad, depressed, a bit down, as opposed to just healthy functioning or not, which seems to be the
Dude, have you seen some of the cognitive feats that corvids? There was a group of, I think, 22 different neuroscientists that came out, I think, in the 2012. They came up with something called the Cambridge Declaration. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Oh, it rings the bell, actually, yeah.
The Cambridge Declaration basically is
Oh, yeah.
all these neuroscientists basically said, okay, we're going to come out of the closet and admit it. A lot of species are self-aware, and we're not just talking gorillas and dolphins and people and elephants. We're talking things like African gray parrots and octopuses, Pacific octopuses, which we believe have near human levels of subjective awareness.
Wow.
Certainly, a lot of brain structures map one to one between the different species. Certainly the ones that involve, they're involved in emotional responses. And just think in terms of our behavior, if the reason sex feels good to us is because if it didn't feel good to us, we wouldn't have kids. It's like it's nature's trick, right? To make us do things, to make us to force us to spread our genes. Nobody's going to have kids if the experience of having them is incredibly unpleasant, because God knows raising a kid for 18 years is going to be incredibly unpleasant on its own. So you want to basically trick the organism into reproducing before it has a chance for second thoughts. So a lot of these things come down to subjective feelings of fulfillment. Sex is one example. The rush you get from sugar and chocolate is another. The enjoyment we get when we look at the fractal geometry. Have you ever seen an ugly fractal? Fractal geometry is so prevalent throughout most of nature, and we associate it, we like fractal patterns because they remind us of healthy topographic environments with lots of places to hide, lots of resources, lots of food. All of these things produce an emotional payoff that I would argue is really no different than the professor's vanity. That's like social status. The professor is getting increased social by hanging next to the left wall. An increased social status in a, you know, back in your Pleistocene tribes, you know, that gets you access to all the best mates. It might get you access to the best food. If people will come to your aid if you are injured. There's all sorts of reasons why social status would be something natural selection would promote. So I would disagree profoundly when you say that there's no real significant payoff in the classroom for the professor. I would say they're tapping into very deep psychological.
His million-year-old man might trick him into thinking there's a payoff, but essentially he's being tricked by that situation. It's a falsely contrived situation.
Yes.
The positive energy coming at him isn't real. It's feigned. It's not actually a reward for anything he's doing, because the audience that's giving him the positive feedback isn't really invested in or interested in or having an emotional response to him being on the left side of the room. The whole thing is socially contrived. So then James's idea is that consciousness, as we're talking about self-awareness, would actually prevent that conditioning from working. So it seems as though what we're looking at here in the social realm is all kinds of contrived situations in which we're being manipulated through conditioning and through triggers and all the rest of it to behave in certain ways, believing we'll get some payoff at an instinctive level, like tapping into our instinctive drives, but essentially we're not getting a payoff.
But I agree with you and I disagree. I mean, you're right. It's our instinctive drives that are doing this. And yes, we're not getting a real payoff, but I disagree that being conscious of it subverts the process. I mean, we watch television, we go to movies. We know when we go to a movie that it's fake, that what they're actually seeing is a documentary, or that they're actually immersed in, you know, Pandora or wherever the movie is set. Mm-hmm. And yet, you get a bond. You know, this is why celebrities, we form these fake bonds, these fake tribal connections with alphas in our social group, even if they're not in our social group, even if we'll never meet them in our lives, we still have that feeling. We still get those payoffs, and we're completely conscious of the fact that we're never going to meet, taking a ludicrous example, Donald Trump. We're never going to have a date with Zoe Saldana, but you know, and we're never going to hang out with those idiots from the series Friends. But even knowing that, the reactions are still there, and they make people spend billions and billions and billions in advertising and TV production for something that they know is fake.
Sure. Well, that's kind of my point, though, because we've been conditioned over generations to buy into a narrative that at some level we know is false. And so our conscious minds telling us we'll never win the lottery isn't enough to override that unconscious conditioning to go out and buy the ticket. But if we do use the self-awareness, if we apply it and really examine our drives, then it does seem, in my own experiences, I used to be a celebrity hound myself. I would try and meet celebrities. My walls were covered with celebrities. I was a movie buff. But I've pretty much emerged from that, what I would call pathology at this point, through self-examination and just recognizing how little of that those conditional responses were actually true to my own psycho-organism. They weren't really an expression of who I am. They were just behaviors that I'd adapted in order to try and survive in my environment.
So Jane's, so get, I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood you. So you basically disagree with Jane's then, that from what I understand, you said that Jane's was stating that if we were aware of, if we could see the smoke and mirrors and the strings, we wouldn't be fooled and we wouldn't react the way we did.
Well, I mean, he was using a specific example, and I think, it's probably pretty uncontestable in that example. If the professor had known, he wouldn't have moved over to the left, right? Or he would have been aware of what he was doing. So I'm not disagreeing with that example. What was it that I said that seemed to disagree?
The impression I got was that he had taken that example and generalized it to say that perhaps one role of consciousness is to keep you from being tricked by these basic hardwired social reward circuits.
That was my kind of extrapolation. I was kind of looking for a possible benefit, survival. Not even survival, but because I don't think it is survival based. I think this is the nut that I keep circling around and have been since I've been looking at your work and writing a little bit around it. Is there a way of perceiving and a way of existing that is fully conscious and that isn't survival based? Because, I mean, that it's fully conscious because it's not survival based, that we're able to perceive our environment in a way that's relatively unencumbered by those necessary deceptions or crucial fictions, because we've uncoupled our perceptions from the survival drive. Like that, I mean, that's the enlightenment goal, right, which you also mentioned in one of your talks.
I think you raise a really interesting, an awesomely interesting suggestion. And I think we might be on the verge of doing that. I mean, we have these brainstem responses because we have brainstems. So, essentially, what about building either in hardware or as some kind of a software emulation, building neural nets that don't come with those instincts attached to standard equipment? I mean, we're already kind of doing that. Again, DARPA are the guys that are working on this. They call it a program called Synapse, which is actually an acronym for something, synapomorphic something electronics. It's like they spent like $8 billion on it so far, and I think they must have spent $4 billion just shoving Scrabble tiles around trying to come up with a cool name that spells Synapse.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, they are on track to build a hardware emulation of a human brain running in real time by the end of this decade. And I don't know how close they are to it. They claim to have met a bunch of milestones, like they've got a cat brain running at 1/10 speed and so on. But why not? Why the hell not? If self-awareness can emerge as a result of some kind of computational algorithm, and why not build self-awareness without the agenda and see what it tells us? It could be an act of torture. I mean, maybe we need our brainstems. Maybe something that is pure intellect without agenda would be insane. I don't know. So there are ethical risks that we would have to consider. But I think it's an experiment that could be done.
It sounds like that would be a way to get around the AI paradox or conundrum and the dread that if we created an intelligent machine it would act in its own interests and therefore destroy all humanity, kind of that premise that is constantly...
Yeah, doesn't that piss you off? Every single one of these shows, in fact there's one going down now, a show called Humans,
yeah,
which is, you know, very nicely acted and very stylish and everything, but the premise is always, you know, as soon as it becomes self-aware, as soon as they become conscious, they'll be just like us, and they will want to be free, or they will want to rise up and eat us or whatever. And again, it implies that we were dumb enough to build these things with instincts and brainstems. And I see no reason why we would do that unless, I mean, and this is what Deep Blue and IBM and some guys over in, I believe, Sweden are working on now. They figure we don't know how the brain works. We don't know how consciousness arises, But we do have the capability of mapping a brain. So whether we understand how it works or not, let's just build this simulation of a brain right down to the individual molecules and see what happens. And if you do that, then of course you're bringing the brainstem along for the ride. And whatever comes out, whatever wakes up there, is actually, if it's a good model, will behave something like the original. So in a situation like that, I mean, if we decided to build our Terminators based on human brains without understanding what parts of the human brain did what, I could certainly see them having agendas, but that would defeat the whole purpose of your experiment.
Right. But, I mean, it seems like the idea of self-awareness and autonomy requires some kind of volition, and volition implies some kind of self-interest, doesn't it?
But why is that? Why does self-awareness imply volition? Why does it imply an agenda?
Hmm.
If you said something about doing a blog thing on Starfish. Have you read Starfish?
I'm busted. I've read like half of it, and this is a while ago.
Don't sweat it. Don't sweat it. The only reason I'm asking is not to bust you, not to break your balls. Yeah. But there was a bit in Starfish where they're actually talking about these head cheeses, which are cultured puddles of neurons that have been essentially inserted into the internet as a way of trying to combat malware. And there's, you know, it's kind of a peripheral throwaway line about the possible rights that these living puddles of neurons would have.
Right.
And it's explicitly stated there, the fact that it's intelligent doesn't mean anything. You know, why should this thing give a rat's ass whether it lives or dies? It doesn't have a brainstem. It doesn't have a survival instinct. Why then is there any ethical compulsion to keep it alive if we don't want it to be alive, when it itself doesn't care whether it's alive?
Right.
Like, why do we make that assumption that if it's self-aware, that it's going to have needs?
You mean beyond the purely physical needs, like emotional needs?
And you dropped out again.
I presume that's what you mean, because any organism would have some sort of biological needs, but if you add the emotional needs to that, then you get the self-interest and the agendas and all the rest of it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're right.
Right. Right. There's a theory of thought, of how thought arises, or self-awareness, not that they're synonymous, but they seem to be related, which is pretty old, but I'll just throw it out anyway, because it relates to this. Robert Ardrey, the African Genesis thing that was very big in the 70s, and I think it comes from him, and it was to do with, and it's probably not exclusive, you're probably familiar with it, but that thought / self-awareness, cogitation, analysis, whatever you want to call it, arose when our environment became too complex, so instincts could no longer cut it. So you have an example of an organism that, this is a simple example, so it's not meant to represent the complexity of our social environment, but an organism who, if it goes down a path, it can find a mate. Like it knows there's a mate down that path, so it has an instinct to go down that path to procreate, but it also senses a predator down that path. And so its instinct of self-preservation is saying, don't go down the path. So it's getting two conflicting signals from its instinctive drives. One is a red light, one's a green light. At that point, some sort of decision needs to be made, and so something that isn't fundamentally instinctive, or is an offshoot of instinct, intervenes or arises in that, which is some sort of computation. Well, the odds of me getting eaten down this path are X, the odds of me getting laid are Y, and then balance out the equation, okay, and makes a decision, yes or no, based on the computation. So that would seem to indicate that thinking, as we know it, and the whole cognitive faculties are sourced in that balancing up of interests. Like, what is it in my interest, or is it not in my interest? As opposed to just being carried by instinct, which is kind of this blissful, you know, pre-fall state that Adam and Eve were supposedly in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I find that utterly plausible. In fact, I find it hard to imagine how intelligence could have arisen any other way than through the need to make those kind of complex decisions. Again, whether or not those questions require self-awareness, could run those algorithms and derive those algorithms, and could, you know, we've had computers now for decades that have been capable of learning intelligently from their mistakes.
Right.
So, but that again is a whole other issue. But yeah, in terms of complex reasoning, yeah, how else could it have happened? I'm sure that's how it happened.
Hmm. So the self-awareness, I think, we talked about this with Solomon, that seems to have entered in, or could have entered in, when or over the process, during a process in which the social environment in which human organisms existed became more and more complex. What our fellows might do was more and more unpredictable, so then we had to cogitate, if that's a word, try and analyze the possibilities of what the other might do, and that's theory of mind. Then we began to imagine that they were thinking, and then we began to think, because when we imagined the mind of the other, that brought about spontaneously a self-awareness thing of being separate from the other. Something like that.
There's a wee bit of circularity in there, I think, in the sense that you know, we had to imagine that they were thinking, and that therefore meant that we start to think. That again is a chicken and egg, because presumably then the only reason they're thinking is because they're trying to do that same thing to us, and if we're not doing that yet, then blah blah blah, you've got the sort of the infinite recursion thing.
Yeah.
I've read from a number of sources the idea that consciousness arose as a result of theory of mind. But nobody, as far as I know, has demonstrated that a theory of mind has to be self-reflective. There's all sorts of ways of saying, oh, look, pupil dilation equals sexual arousal, initiate mating rituals, versus, oh, look, bared teeth and club or 2x4 with nail in it coming to my head, initiate flight response.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of cues and coming to conclusions about what the other person is going to do that don't involve an actual subjective theory of mind. One of the coolest theories about consciousness I've read is from a guy called Morcella. And his argument is that consciousness arose as a way of mediating conflicting motor commands to the skeletal muscles. And the example he gives is you're carrying a really, really hot tray across the carpet and it's burning your fingers. And so you really want to drop the tray, but at the same time, you don't want to mess up your pristine carpet. So there are two conflicting motor commands. One is hold onto the tray and the other is drop the tray. And you become intensely aware in such moments in a way which, you know, you don't think about what your hands are feeling at any given time. You don't think about driving from point A to point B. You just sort of do it automatically until something unforeseen happens. A kid jumps out in front of the car, and all of a sudden, you're conscious of what's going on. You don't want to hit the brakes because then you go through the windshield. On the other hand, you want to hit the brakes because otherwise you're going to hit the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy points out a really interesting idea in that you actually become more intensely conscious
when your body is trying to,
basically the subconscious brain is capable of doing all sorts of really complex things, and as long as it's doing complex things without conflict, it can do all the heavy lifting itself. But when it's trying to do two separate complex things and it doesn't really know which one of those to go with, that's when you become conscious, or at least according to Morcella, that's what consciousness originally evolved to do.
Mm.
And I found that fascinating. My latest book, I actually had this reference to these cultists called prismatics, who would like literally put themselves in glass caskets and almost drown themselves, because it's hard to imagine a greater conflict between the urge to breathe and the urge to hold your breath, because if you breathe, you're going to drown.
Right.
So these people, in order to achieve an enlightened state of consciousness, would try to drown themselves to try and provoke that kind of a conflict.
Wow.
I don't know if there's anything to the theory, and once again, it doesn't explain why that conflict has to involve self-reflection. But I think it's a really, really cool idea.
Mm. It's also very basic kind of mathematic binary, that the universe is binary and that there's no oneness. Like it's either nothing or it's a polarity. So yeah, consciousness only comes about with a split, and of course that split can then be extended to the self, and the other would be the social split.
And that since then it's kind of bled out like ink on a tablecloth, right? Consciousness has kind of permeated a lot of our other behaviors. But his argument is this is probably how it got started.
Right. Yeah, well, that I think, and that speaks to what I was trying to get earlier about complexity, is that it seems to have snowballed. Like once there was a split in the body trying to do two things at once, there was a split, and then that led to a kind of consciousness that allowed for us to think one thing and do another, so to speak, and that complexified the human behavior, and that would have snowballed until we're existing in such an incredibly complex system that instinct is very hard to even access, really. Like, in terms of just returning to an instinctive way of being, that doesn't seem feasible. So then it's, well, are we moving? And so that would be like returning to unconsciousness anyway. What would be the point in that? Like,
So there's also those cases of sleep sexers. I don't know if you've heard of them. There's a case of a woman, I think in Australia, who basically would go out cruising. She would go out cruising nightclubs. She would have sex with people. And she'd be asleep the whole time. There was a guy right here in Toronto who a few years ago was acquitted of murder because he did it in his sleep. He basically got out of bed, drove across town, killed somebody, cleaned up the mess, drove back to bed, asleep the whole time.
Yeah, I know, I heard about that, and he was exonerated.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, if you can do that, if you can commit murder, if you can drive, if you can clean stuff up while not being conscious, what's left for consciousness to do?
Well, okay, but this is back to the mystery here, because it's something James writes about, that consciousness, I mean self-consciousness, or what we identify as consciousness, is like a flashlight. So it only sees what it's shining on, and then the stuff it doesn't see is just darkness, and so it doesn't acknowledge it's there. So we have this sense that what we call consciousness is it, but actually we're not conscious of the stuff we're unconscious of. See, in my court of law, that guy wouldn't have been exonerated, because his body committed the murder, and he is his body much more than he is his just conscious ego self. So, and just in pure psychological terms, that it was unconscious drives that led him to do that, and that's what leads anyone to commit murder. So just because he had a convenient, I mean, that he suppressed that unconscious life so thoroughly that there was absolutely no bleed through, that wouldn't make it any less him. And by the same token, it seems that who we are is 99% unconscious, and yet we're trying to analyze consciousness from that little bandwidth of 1% and reach conclusions based on this faulty premise that what we're not conscious of isn't who we are.
Yeah, I think you're 100% on the money there. The problem is our it on this fallacy that we are what we think consciously. We are what we are aware of. It's a the legal system itself is kind of at fault. I think maybe under neither you nor I would let the guy off, except we probably would if we were sitting on a jury, because the jury would be charged with following the law, and the law is based on the whole notion of legal culpability basically implies, complex behavior equals free will, that there is volition, that there is no subconscious, that when your body does things, if you're not consciously aware of them, then that's not you. I mean, you and I agree, and a lot of other people agree, that what we consider to be us, like the little homunculus looking out from behind the eyes, that's just basically this little bit of scum floating on the top of the system. It's a subroutine, right, on the surface, and all the real heavy lifting happens underneath. And we consist of the whole system, conscious and subconscious parts. The legal system is predicated on the assumption that that little layer of scum on the top is all there is. And so you've got to judge the person on the basis of just that little layer of scum floating on the surface. So if the little conscious layer of scum doesn't know about it, then we have to let the guy walk. I think that's the way that the legal system is set up.
Because the first thing I mentioned when I reached out to you was, maybe it's related, it's all related, was about paedophiles laying the groundwork for the singularity. I thought that that might imply something quite different than I think it does, because I've been looking into paedophilia networks in the UK and how it relates to some kind of social engineering and very complex stuff. So I thought maybe you were going there. But what I've guess from other stuff I've read of you is that it relates to brain damage and paedophiles being so socially outcast that they would be the first to volunteer to mutate or something. Is that right?
That's pretty much the way. I mean, I was also throwing Catholic sex abusers in there too. The argument basically being that. And this is something that I think the transhumanists don't give enough attention to, is that when you become post-human, by definition, you're not human anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just talking. I mean, everybody wants to be able to jump tall buildings at a single bound. Everybody wants to be stronger and have telescopic eyesight and have sex as often as they like and live in an immortal Tupperware android shell that will never die. But those things simply preserve what you already are in a chassis with a longer warranty.
Yeah.
By definition, being truly post-human means turning into something else.
Right.
And the gut has spent 4.5 billion years being shaped to not want to turn into something else. It doesn't know the difference between turning into something else and death.
Right.
And in fact, I don't think there is really. So it's you know, if somebody wants to turn you into a humanoid Superman, you get. Somebody says, we're going to turn you into a multi-tentacled banana slug with 18 eyes, because that's the body that is best suited for this new level of most people are just going to recoil and say, Dad, burn up, Martha, that just ain't natural. and there's going to be, I mean, hell, look how so many people react even to trans and gay people, right? I mean, the idea, and those are just relatively minor tweaks in an already extant spectrum that's been around for thousands. People are going to react to true transhumanism. I think on the gut level, most people will think that that's tantamount to suicide, and their gut won't let them go ahead with it. And that leaves behind only those to whom suicide is a step up. And that basically means people who are just absolutely miserable with their lives, people who are outcasts, people who have nowhere else to go. And they would have nothing else to lose. And I figure the idea of using our outcasts as early adopters for the new technology leaves some really interesting questions about what happens when the rest of us screw up our nerve and follow them in there. What kind of ground rules will...
Yeah, no kidding. That's like a transhumanist version of the colonizing Australia with convicts. So.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that's a really good analogy.
Although I think a lot of those people weren't actually convicts, where they were just they were outcasts and undesirables who were treated as such, as fodder.
Hey, it still makes a good metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a dream once, some many years back, actually, more like a vision, in which I turned into a spider, and it was very visceral. It wasn't just a nice, easy dream transition. The spider actually burst out of my human body, like my human body was a shell or a chrysalis for it. So these limbs came tearing out of my sides, and then the rest of me.
What were you? What was your perspective? Were you third person? Were you the spider? Were you the spider burrowing out? Were you the person looking down at the spider?
I was the person looking down. I was me as I more or less experienced myself at that time, and this other life was actually being born through me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty nightmarish, but I did see it as a positive dream.
That is a form of transformation for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point being is that that's absolutely how it is, I think. Transformation means that you lose the old form and a new form takes its place, not in some sort of teleportation thing, but presumably more like nature occurs, even if it's at a psychological rather than a biological level. Of transhumanism, it is biological, but nature destroys the old organism and then reassembles the components, right, into a new entity.
Yeah.
So that's annihilation, really. And I mean, I think that's...
We could get around that, is to do it really gradually. Who was that who basically came up with a thought experiment? I've forgotten his name. The guy, basically, you replace your entire brain one neuron at a time with silicone prosthesis. So that at every point, you're still the same person. It's just now one neuron less is organic and has been replaced. You know that's the thought experiment? You know that? It's pretty famous. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I haven't heard that one before, no.
And his question, obviously, is at what person does this person stop being... Is it like when the last fleshy neuron is replaced by silicon? Is it when the first fleshy neuron is replaced, when half of his brain has been taken over? Because he's got that continuity of consciousness all the way through. It happened gradually. And his... Of course... He never stops being human. The way the information is moving in the head is still the same way.
Right, in theory.
And I think that might be a way of getting around the Dad Burn It Murtha response. You are not the same person you were 30 years ago, right?
Sure. Well, literally, biologically, they say anyway that none of the
But cells, you're also... Also, you're not, you know, in terms of your maturity, in terms of your outlook, you know, aspects of you have changed. And you don't consider that an incredibly tumultuous or traumatic spider eruption event because it happened so slowly. So I'm wondering if maybe we could sort of sneak into this through the back door by doing it really, really slowly.
Well, I think that's probably what's happening, isn't it? And just not in such a literal way as you're describing, but through the interface with technology via the internet. So people becoming more and more, existing more and more through a Facebook identity, to use the cliche, and through their apps and their, their appendages, and of course, Google goggles, whatever. So the border of the skin is pretty much has already been penetrated, so that's not a real border. So yeah, I mean, little by little, people are becoming cyborgs and kind of generating and living through a virtual identity self. So that I'd say is happening. Whether it's desirable and whether it's going to lead to the desired outcome, I would question that assumption.
There's a woman called Sparrow. I've forgotten her first name. She came up with a paper, came out in Science, I think, in maybe 2008, 2009, and she actually reported that our physical brain structure was changing, that the parts of our brain we used to use to store information, we now use to store search protocols for finding that information online. In the same sense that London cab drivers in the days before GPS, parts of their brain devoted to spatial mapping were physically hypertrophied. Like you could see physical gross structural changes in the brains of these people. And you can see why, because obviously they're cabbies and they need to know a lot of locations. They need to find the way around. But you're right, that kind of stuff is happening to us even now, just as a result of our reliance on Google. And the physical macro anatomy of our brain changes. There are actual you can actually see on the motor strip, the somatosensory motor cortex of compulsive gamers, the parts of the brain, the motor strip that operate the thumbs. Are disproportionately large than they are in other people. So yeah, the brain's a really flexible muscle. You make a good point. It's probably already happening, and I shouldn't be talking about it as though it was theoretical.
Well, I also think it's happening in a way that is certainly very different from what the transhumanists envision, and maybe the opposite. So, for example, neurodiversity is what you're talking about. I mean, not specifically related to taxi drivers, but the mutational aspect presumably can be traced to social factors, primarily technology, I think. And so neurodiversity, autism being on the most easily identified manifestation of
Sorry, did you
neurodiversity.
say autism on the spectrum?
Yeah, so autists have larger brains, essentially. They have a lot more receiving pads on the brains. I forget the technical terms for it. So they're receiving more data, but the processing power isn't necessarily greater. In terms of actually translating that data into something that can be expressed and that can be fitted into the social matrix in which autists are being born into. So, I mean, neurodiversity is a diversion. It's an evolutionary offshoot, it seems as though. And so these and this is where it overlaps with starfish and your whole thing about dysfunctionals being more innovative. Because of course autists are highly dysfunctional, but they're also, I mean, a large part of the innovation that's occurred in computing can be attributed to autists. So yeah, there's a whole.
My understanding is that autistics tend to have a deficit of white matter. And so the individual modules, the cortical modules in the brain of gray matter, tend to be more isolated one from another. So those isolated modules, because they're not as interconnected, have to become hyper efficient on their own. Are you aware of some of the studies they've done on people with radical hydrocephaly, which sometimes like 95% of the brain cavity is filled with spinal fluid. So they basically got 5% of the mass. And some of these people have above average IQs.
Right.
Get honors in mathematics and so on, and nobody can figure out how it happens. And one of the suggestions is it might be hyper isolation of cortical modules makes them super, like, hyper efficient. In the same way that that might actually be the case with people with high functioning autistic savants. And what a great way to, I mean, if we could do that surgically, if you could sort of go in and burn out some of your own white matter to make yourself, to supercharge your brain, that might be kind of an awesome thing.
For a sci-fi novel, maybe. I'm not sure I'd want to.
Well, it's at least worth a blog post. When our lockdown was all winter with ice in you, now you're melting, the summer's sweltering as you're leaning from what you're gleaning. The diddy man, you chuckle free, you live your life in fantasy. Sapphire, I know you, sapphire will grow you, sapphire will closer as we broke her. And did you say you're on my plane? I'm coming back. I love Elaine. I love Elaine.
Different flavors, sunny poacher, the day is over as you're leaning from what you're gleaning. The diddy wife, you chuckle free, you live your life in fantasies. Sapphire, I know you, sapphire will grow you, sapphire will closer as we broke her. And did you say
written about autism directly yet so far?
Have I not written about autism what?
Directly, because it seems you're always kind of implicitly referring to it, not always, but in a lot of things.
You know, you are very perceptive about that. I do not use the word autistic in my books. It's not so much a question of cultural appropriation as in, I just don't know fuck all about autism. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't write about any cultural group or any neurological group that I was completely ignorant of. And while I've read, you know, I'll write about marine biology because I got a few degrees in that. I'll read about stuff that I have researched. I haven't researched the neurodiverse. So I've been very careful to, although I'll mention autistic references sections in my books, I'm generally pretty careful not to use the word autistic when I describe my neuroatypical characters in my novels. So they may show many behavioral characteristics that you would associate with autistics.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been careful to basically, nobody can point at me and say, you're an ignorant person spreading lies about what the autistic community is like, because they would probably be right if they said that.
Mm-hmm.
And to avoid doing that, the people in my novels have been genetically engineered to the point where there's something new. They're the way lots of people, or, you know, the way lots of autistics manifest, and they're entirely different. They were engineered that way for different purposes, and they're perfectly well adapted in their environment. Right? It's not considered a disability at all. In fact, in the last two novels I wrote, it's the baseline cavemen that are considered the roaches, the primitive, maladapted, falling behind the curve people, and it's really the augments that are taking over.
I'm thinking we should wind up soon because the signal keeps cutting out, but I actually don't want to wind up because there's really interesting things to talk about. So I'll just bring up one thing anyway, and that is Behemoth, the microorganism. Okay, so I haven't read your Behemoth books. I've only read Summer Starfish, but I've been riffing off it anyway, this idea of the microorganism that gives these dysfunctionals a fighting chance in the face of the...
Wait a free second. A, you're cutting out a lot, so I'm not sure I'm getting what you're saying. But B, you want to talk about Behemoth? Behemoth doesn't show up in Starfish until almost the end of the book.
Right. So, but he shows up in Behemoth. It, I mean...
Who are we talking... Behemoth shows up in...
In Behemoth.
Are you telling me you read Behemoth before you read Starfish?
No, I haven't. It's my wife who reads your books. She loves them, and so she was like, talk to Peter Watts. And so what I've been doing, besides reading Starfish, is listening to your talks and your interviews.
Right, okay. Sorry, I was just wondering how you would know about Behemoth if you hadn't reached that point in the novel yet, but that makes sense.
Yeah, you gave it away.
Right.
Yeah, so, but all I got from that was Behemoth as a microorganism, which you felt you had to invent to give the dysfunctionals a fighting chance.
Yeah.
So my question about Behemoth, this microorganism, is going to sound probably really weird because I've gone off on my own track about this, but one of my sort of models for understanding what's gone on with consciousness and how it's become this kind of weird distortion of perception and this false reality creator thing is relates to language and how language has embedded itself in consciousness at such a deep level that we can't perceive or think about anything unless we can apply it or filter it through language, basically process it through a language system.
Okay.
So my question about this microorganism is, or my kind of feeling about it was that it has something to do with this, something to do with something that can actually bypass language or access consciousness without getting caught up in the matrix of language. This could be completely off the wall and have nothing to do with Behemoth, but I throw it out there anyway.
Oddly enough, given that it does sound like you kind of pulled that out of your ass, but oddly enough, it actually kind of comes into its own in the next book, Maelstrom. Behemoth is simply a pre-DNA, a very ancient microbe that predates the existence of DNA.
Oh, well, there you go, because DNA is language, right? Sorry, carry on.
It's got RNA-based. And the thing about it is that because it cannot stand... high salinity and cold temperatures in the peculiarities of its cell wall. It's been trapped in the deep sea near these hydrothermal rift vents. But if it ever gets out, if it ever makes it to shore, it will outcompete everything on land. It'll basically rewrite the biosphere from DNA up, and anything based on DNA is in danger. So this becomes an existential threat to all life as we know it. And so none of that has anything to do with language. But where the story gets, you know, closer to that is that Behemoth ends up actually being protected by the smart gels, by the AIs in the net that have been programmed to essentially allow simple files to pass through, while at the same time stopping viruses and malware, which are more complex. And from this, the head cheeses have learned essentially a generalized preference for simple complete systems over against complex ones. And because the behemoth ecosystem is so much simpler and the planetary biosphere, they start leaving back doors open to allow essentially behemoth to start making inroads onto the planet. At the same time, there are social memes that occur in which one of the people that survived the nuclear explosion and the event that was supposed to take out the rifters, drivers there ends up becoming essentially kind of a pop messiah.
Sorry, who does? So, you cut out.
One of the characters who survives the explosion at the end of Starfish. I don't want to spoil too much of it for you.
Sure, yeah.
She becomes essentially, I mean, the question is, she's one person with an entire world gunning for her, so why don't they just wipe her out instantly, right? And the reason they don't is that the entire internet is starting to protect her because of various essentially linguistic mistakes and memes that are spreading through the culture to the point where this character strings associated with this person get classified as things to be protected. I explain it better in the books, I would hope, than I'm doing now. But it's interesting that you bring up the language thing, because I had absolutely no intention of dealing with behemoth and language in any sense anywhere in the trilogy. But as it turned out, memes and character strings and nucleic acids all formed essentially the central thread. Without those, the plot for Maelstrom could not exist. So you kind of threw a dart over your shoulder and hit the bullseye.
Yeah, I was using the force.
Yeah.
Well, I think it has to do with you being a very intuitive writer, is the sense I get. That they're very worked out and you have a very strong intellectual interest in stuff, but it seems that the concepts that you're working with are coming from a very deep place, is my sense. And then that's what I tune into, is actually what's underneath the story and underneath the subtext, even to something that's emerging, maybe Lovecraft-like, but anyway, from some whole other dimension, and through fiction, which I do believe is a real phenomenon, that things that are in the unconscious that are coming into physical form very slowly, they first emerge through fiction, I think.
Let me tell you a shameful secret about my quote intuitive unquote process.
Yeah.
You're right. I lay everything out in exquisite and excruciating detail. I write 20, 30 page novel outlines. Cory Doctorow once said that I did not write outlines, I wrote novels without dialogue. So I write these incredibly detailed layouts of the plot, scene by scene. And then I start writing the novel. Two-thirds of the way through the novel, when I suddenly realize that I haven't taken this factor into account, or that I didn't think about that other thing which subverts the entire plot, and all my work and all my careful planning goes right out the window, and I have to start writing by the seat of my pants.
Right.
And that's pretty much how every one of my novels has gone. I spend an enormous amount of time researching it and plotting it out, and then I try and follow that outline. And I always fuck up because the outline is never good enough, and the outline always misses. Never realize that until I'm almost finished the book, and then I have to do this intuitive thing that you're talking about. Maybe I should probably just start with the intuitive stuff to begin with and save myself a lot of time.
It sounds like maybe that wouldn't happen if you didn't have that illusory safety net that gets you up on the high wire to begin with, even though the high wire goes way further than the safety net could ever reach, or something like that.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
Anders was so. The monkey said, when this world come tumbling.
I said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the man kind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down. The monkey, the monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey. Oh, here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Mais les voleurs de bois nous posent des problèmes. Songe sur les arbres prêts.